Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. It is time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio. I'm Eric Olson. Very excited to be here as usual. Teresa is off for the evening, but we are talking creature feature Poseidon Rex with Hollywood legend, director Mark Lester. Amphibious freaking T-Rex, people. That's a whole lot of destructo power rampaging over land and sea. Poseidon Rex, a small, secluded island off the coast of Belize, suddenly finds itself terrorized by a deadly predator from Earth's distant past when deep-sea divers accidentally awaken an ancient evil. Oh, man, there's a lot going on here, and it all looks great. Man, I want to be there even with Poseidon Rex rampaging over hill and dale and water and chomping up mostly gangsters, so that's good. But let's talk about Mark Lester, Mark L. Lester. He, believe it or not, has been around for a while. Writer, director, producer Mark L. Lester is best known for helming the Arnold Schwarzenegger starring box office mega hit Commando, Stephen King's supernatural thriller Firestarter with Drew Barrymore and Martin Sheen, Showdown in Little Tokyo with Dolph Lundgren and the late Brandon Lee in his first major role, and two frighteningly prophetic films about the state of society, Class of 1984 with Michael J. Fox in his first film role, and the sequel, Class of 1999, which coincidentally came out in 1990. In 2005, for you sci-fi fans, sci-fi channel fans, he produced and directed Pterodactyl, the highest-rated sci-fi channel feature film up to that time. For more than 20 years, Mark Lester oversaw the development and distribution of over 100 films at American World Pictures, and he founded Titan Global Entertainment in 2012 to carry on the tradition for many, many years to come. Welcome, Mark Lester.
Oh, thank you, Eric. Nice to hear from you.
Well, the pleasure is mine. You're a man who has done a lot.
Yes, I've been around a while. I've been making films for 40 years, right through the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. It's been a lot of fun, and I keep shooting and shooting.
That is amazing. 40 years, because relatively, you're not that old. You started very young.
Yes, I did. I started right out of college, and I've been shooting ever since. I started in the drive-in business with Truck Stop Women and Steel Arena, Bobby Joe and the Outlaw, starred Linda Carter, stunts with Robert Forster, and kept going from there.
It's amazing. I was going through the list, and I thought, I've seen that one. And, you know, I knew your name, and I knew some of the highlights, but, you know, as is often the case, especially with veterans, I mean, there's so much to attach to your name that you've done, so much experience, so many people you've worked with. It's really amazing. So tell us about Poseidon Rex. How did it come to be? As I always do, I watched, I don't know, about three quarters of it, because I never want to see the ending before I talk about it. Same thing with books. I don't read the ending before I talk about them, because I am compulsive. I give it away. But from what I've seen, you know, look, there are creature features that get the name, the title, you know, kind of campy attached to them. And then there are creature features. This is well done. It looks really good. The acting is, I mean, it's good, you know.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. I shot it down in Belize. And it's, you know, I wanted to do something like the old movie I love, Beast of 20,000 Fathoms, and Godzilla, of course, which is coming out another one. And so, you know, it's of that type of film, and it's a lot of fun, very entertaining. And Belize, we had, you know, we could use the ocean out there. It's beautiful Caribbean background. It's in Central America, though. And then it was a lot of fun shooting, a lot of action on the ocean with the creature chasing people. And we had the local actors. Some of them were the local drug dealers, I found out. They were rewriting their dialogue to make it more colloquial for the country, but you know, it was a great place to shoot, a lot of fun, and it looks like a great movie.
Yeah, I mean, it really does, and those, just the colors, I mean, it looks really well done. You know, it looks like the money is up on the screen, which is always what you want to hear. You know, some of the stuff, I mean, I enjoy a lot of the sci-fi channel movies, and I see you did Pterodactyl. You know, they're fun. This one looks like a real movie. It doesn't look like a TV movie. And it's like you say, the action's great. There's some tongue-in-cheek humor to it. There's a little romance. There's lots of hot girls. What more do you want, man?
No, that's the idea. A lot of fun. It's like an old-fashioned 50s movie, but updated for today. And I even, you know, I put a little Into the Blue in there where they go underwater. And, you know, we had a lot of underwater scenes and diving scenes. It came out really well. It was very exciting to make. And CGI now, you can do amazing things with these creatures. I mean, it looks unbelievable. You can compare that creature to what originally was Jurassic Park. I watched it again, and I went, wow, this is just as good, because now you can do just that level.
Right, exactly. We've certainly seen plenty of advancement in that field, and people are accustomed, you know, to seeing it. If anything, I find a lot of people become kind of jaded about it, but you know, they take it for granted. When I'm looking at it, especially anything in the distance, any distance shots or, you know, medium distant and back, I mean, there's no way you'd know. That looks like a freaking T-Rex rampaging. It is wild. It is fun. So tell us how it came to be. What drew you to this, and what was the impetus behind it and just putting it together in general?
Well, it was to, you know, create a creature like the old movies, like I say, Beast with 20,000 Fathoms or Godzilla, and to, you know, make it modern day and contemporary and have a story, you know, it's like a story where they find drugs, but in doing so and blowing up a ship underwater, this creature comes out from the past and attacks the drug dealer and his friends and, you know, goes on a rampage through this Central American nation. And so they, you know, it was to make a really fun, exciting movie and shoot it. And so, you know, I'm doing a whole series of these now. I have a new one I'm going to shoot called Vikings versus Dinosaurs. And it'll be, you know, that'll be a really fun creature feature. And I finished Dragons of Camelot is already shot. So I'm just doing the CGI in that. So I'm just, you know, having some fun making a whole bunch of these just to see, you know, how this genre works out. And then I'm also doing a remake of Class of 1984, so doing all kinds of different pictures.
Oh, are you really? Well, tell us about that one.
Pardon?
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so
that's a classic.
You know, if you remember the original, it was prophetic because at the beginning of the movie, it said if we don't stop high school violence now, you know, it'll become rampant in the country, and that's what happened. And so, you know, I'm updating the whole thing to contemporary, and it's going to take place actually in a private school because the society, the rich people, have retreated to private schools, but it doesn't get them away from the gangs that are there that will be rich kids now. So it's like a different take on it, but it takes place today. And I'm going to shoot that, and then right after Vikings versus Dinosaurs.
Vikings?
They don't really go together, do they? But you know,
no,
I like
I'm thinking cold weather, you know, Vikings. Are you watching that series, by the way?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Oh, my God. I'll tell you what, that scene, this is the truth. Anyone who's been, I haven't talked about it through the America's Most Haunted outlet, but anyone who's hooked into me or my family on Facebook, we were watching that last episode, I guess it's Thursday night, and at the end of it, oh my God! You know they execute the rival, and it's not that he didn't deserve it, but it's this protracted, awful torture scene. And this, I'm not kidding. We were watching it in bed. I literally fainted. I passed out, dead away. And my wife thought I had a heart attack or a stroke or something. She was losing her mind. She called 911. She said I was literally out for like at least 30 seconds. I mean, it was crazy. And then I was talking to my daughter, my oldest daughter, and she had had something somewhat similar happen in a movie theater under similar circumstances about 10 years ago. And what she was diagnosed is, said if you're empathetic, if you empathize with that person, and if your guard is down, you can actually take on, you know, psychologically the burden of actually suffering through. And it was the realism that bothered me so much. It really felt real. So I literally passed out. I mean, it's embarrassing. Who passes out at movies? It's crazy. That's what Vikings did to me. That's how realistic it was, or that's how engaged I was in it.
Wow. Well, you know, we'll have the Vikings and the dinosaurs together, and they were on Earth at the same time, you know, if you believe in the Bible, right? The Vikings and dinosaurs fought each other.
Well, certain
they even had saddles for dinosaurs.
Yes, that's right. Isn't that in the Creation Museum?
Yes, that's right.
And that's depicted. Bill Nye just had a very civil debate with the I think it's in Kentucky, I believe, the Creation Museum.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. They were respectful of each other. I think it was actually a very positive thing. I think it was a good example of how people from extraordinarily different backgrounds and different world views should conduct their affairs. It was actually really it was very interesting. So when you're putting together these more genre-based movies, how is that different from, say, when you're doing, you know, a major studio, big budget affair? How do you go about gathering the cast and deciding, you know, how much you're going to put into effects? Because, of course, in that kind of a film, in a genre film, the effects are very important, especially in this day and age when people really are pretty sophisticated.
Well, we're doing like this Poseidon, there's 200 CGI shots in there. And, you know, if you do them independently outside the studios, you can get a lot of value. People don't charge you as much. And, of course, you know, we don't have as long a shooting schedule as studio films. So while I was doing the bigger budget films, you could shoot for 40, 50 days, whereas these we don't shoot that long. But there's a big cost savings here in shooting in another country where it's very inexpensive and, you know, that you don't have all the big union crews. So by controlling the production like that, we can make, you know, a very good film for a lot less money than a studio would be able to do.
Yeah, like I said, it looks good. It looks well done. I mean, you can tell serious players are behind it, and, of course, that would be primarily you. I mean, you've been doing it for a long time, and that the quality and the authority really shows. What, just backing up just a little bit, what in doing, I mean, you really had that run in the 80s. I mean, you had a real serious major film successful run. What did you learn at that time that you've been able to carry over to things you've been doing more on your own, and when you're doing a larger volume of things? What did you learn then that is helping you do things the way you do them now?
Well, tremendous experience in preparation. You can, you know, you prepare for a long time with storyboards and proper locations and spending a lot of time in pre-production, really planning everything. And then, you know, I know how to shoot really quick, so I can get a lot of value, because even then, if you, with that experience, you can shoot really fast, and you know, you just learn how to make a movie, and that's, you know, not many people can really make a film. A lot of people try, but you know, and then today it's easier with the digital equipment now, so you don't have the big cost of the processing film, and the editing's cheaper, and everything's cheaper. So, in that sense, you can do that, but you really learn how to work in all kinds of different situations. And I started in low-budget films, so I grew to bigger budgets and then smaller budgets. And I can work on any budget level. It really doesn't matter, because if the story's fun and interesting, there's fun characters and some interesting things happening, it's exciting, you know, it can be any budget. People don't really go like that. I've seen big studio films with huge budgets, and they're boring as could be. And then you can see a little tiny film, and even these horror films that are out there are really well done. They don't cost that much, like Insidious or Oculus or Devil Within or Last Exorcist. I've seen all these movies, and they're really well done for very small budgets in the supernatural genre.
Right. Well, I think all the ones you just said are Bloom-oriented, right? Boy, he's certainly doing well.
Yeah. Oh, they are, actually. Yeah.
But, I mean, it is a volume game. I just read, it's a big article. I'm sure everyone read it, to kind of detailing how he works and the process that he goes through. And, you know, anyone who does that well and who does well on a relatively low budget is always going to have critics, of course, from varying directions, from whether they be, jealousy or just whatever. But, he's not always right. I mean, it's a matter of volume, and you can do that when you're working at relatively low budgets. You can do a lot of volume. You still have to know what you're doing. You still have to have the judgment. You still have to try to maximize your percentage, your home run percentage, or at least your on base percentage, shall we say, and minimize. You know, everyone, including him, have had plenty of films that haven't worked, but he's certainly on a roll. I suppose he's kind of on a roll now, like you were in the 80s, and that's the way it goes, right? I mean, it's just sometimes things come together and you're in fashion and you're at the top of your game and all the pieces fit together, and then other times, hey, you don't think you're doing anything different. You're plugging away, doing your thing, working hard, having fun, and it's just not everything aligns the same way. Is that a fair characterization? I mean, do you think of it that way, that you're just kind of going along doing your thing, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, you'll keep plugging away?
Yes, no, that's the way. I just keep going because you can't stop, or let anybody stop you. You just have to keep shooting, and Hollywood it's built of ups and downs. Careers are long. I just saw Schwarzenegger on a talk show, and he said he's starting at the bottom again, but the fun is starting, building back up again. And I mean, everybody goes through different stages, so you have to just keep working and working, and the business changes very, very fast, so you have to keep up with new type of filmmaking and what audiences want, and that's, you just have to keep shooting and working and doing that, not be stopped by anything, really.
Did the real changeover come technically onto the digital side? When did that really – when was the critical mass of that switchover?
Well, for us, I think just about everywhere, like around 2005 and 6, I made the movie Pterodactyl for – it was a big network release in 35 millimeter. And then from then on, we've been, shooting – I made a couple other movies on 35, and then everything switched over. I mean, there's – I don't think, in 2 years there won't be a single movie shot in 35 millimeter, if there are even today. So that whole aspect of filmmaking is completely gone, which is sad because that's a beautiful look to a film. But it's a lot cheaper to shoot than with these digital cameras than with 35 millimeter. So that changeover has already happened.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. I was just wondering, I mean, you said when it was. So, I mean, it's still pretty recent. It's in the last several years. What do you have to do different just from a technical standpoint? I mean, what did you have to learn to use digital?
Well, with film, you could only afford to shoot so much film. Even on a big studio film, they would come to the set and go, "You're using too much film," because it was so expensive to process. So you'd learn to rehearse everybody and then do a take and then shoot in one or two takes. I could do a whole film like that. But with the digital, you can just keep the camera running forever, and people do. And there's no real discipline to that, but you can just keep rolling and rolling. There's no cost to it. It's just a computer chip. So, people spend a lot of time shooting what would be a million feet of film would have cost you millions of dollars to process. Now it's free. So, that's the whole discipline right there that one has to learn in that changeover from film to digital. But it does, it does get you better acting and everything, because people can keep acting until they get it right.
Interesting. That there's actually really a parallel there to the music recording industry and their switchover to digital, primarily at least, was much earlier. It became, I suppose, even a couple, decades earlier in some ways anyway. But I'm hearing a lot of the same things that you just said. I heard from various producers. I wrote the Encyclopedia of Record Producers back in the late 90s and interviewed all kinds of producers. It was really interesting. A lot of my background is in music, covering music. So, but a lot of the same things were said, whereas in the past, the actual recording process was relatively expensive, and the materials were relatively expensive, so that you had to be prepared. And a lot of what a producer did, many producers anyway, was work on the rehearsals and go over things and practice and practice and practice and work on arrangements and help them get it figured out and tweak the sound and get the engineering side of it the way you want it, and then record it in as relatively few takes as possible. So that's kind of similar to what you're saying. So it seems to me like where the discipline side of it has been kind of transferred then is into the editing. Sounds like you must have a much larger editing task now with a larger amount of recorded work.
Right. So, yes, but on the other hand, it's quicker to do because you have this digital editing in a computer and there's no more splicing and cutting each you know, shot of film. Like on Commando, we had five editors there working to get the picture ready. Now one editor can do the job of five people just quickly making these cuts and changes and saving all the different versions. You can't do that in film. You can only do one version at a time, this kind of thing. So that's all been really, you know, vastly improved with technology.
Interesting. And you're saying what's given up, though, is that certain look of film, the kind of the ravishing look of film. Is there any way to hybrid it? Can you get the film look and still use digital?
Well, the digital cameras, they, you know, every time there's a new one, they say, oh, it looks more and more like film. So the idea for the digital people is to keep getting a camera that's going to shoot a movie that looks like a film movie. So that's interesting. They don't just accept the fact that they're digital and that's good enough look. It's more to make it look like film. So, you know, eventually that will happen. They'll be able to add enough grain in it to make it look film. But I don't know if that certain quality will ever be there again. And I don't know that anybody cares because most people just are looking at the story and the characters and, you know, what they want to do. And now even with the CGI, it's so much easier to do on digital than it is on film. So there's all kinds of benefits to digital. But, you know, I heard David Lynch speak about it once, and he said it's wonderfully horrible. And I think that explains it.
Hey, being the veteran that you are, I would love to hear, and I know that the listeners would too, if you could just maybe walk us through the main phases. You certainly don't have to go into a lot of detail, unless you want to. But just say, take the current one, the Poseidon Rex. Could you just kind of walk us through from kind of the very beginning to the end? Again, as much detail as you want. Doing a light version is absolutely fine. But I'm not sure when I have a fair understanding of how it works just because I've been watching, seen it, and I've been on sets and that kind of thing, and I've done some TV and whatnot. So I have a basic understanding, and I've talked to lots of film people. But I'm always learning things, and there's always stages of it that or portions of it that I hadn't really thought about. And I know that's absolutely the case for listeners. So if you wouldn't mind doing that, or if you wanted to pick another film, that's fine. But just as an example, and just kind of walk us through the process. I'd love to hear from someone who is as good at it and as experienced at it as you are.
In terms of from the start of the filmmaking process, yes.
Yeah, just kind of step by step. And like I say, if you want to go into any, you know, you can go to whatever depth of detail that you would like on the various stages. But even just a run through of just the basic, you know, fundamental steps that you go through from when you decide to work on a film. And,
well, the way
as I
these
say,
films
if you
are
want...
working is kind of interesting because what we're doing, like with Poseidon Rex or Dragons of Camelot I just shot, or what will be Vikings versus Dinosaurs, and what we did before our movie Sand Sharks and Dragon Wasp, these, all these kind of creature features, fun movies, what we're doing is we work up, you know, a title and an idea. So then we do artwork and an ad campaign, and we go to overseas to different conventions. So I make sure that the distributors around the world, the networks, like the idea for the film. And then we take orders and we get them to say, okay, if we finish the movie and we deliver it, will you buy the film for your country? And then enough people say yes, and we look like we can have our production budget covered mostly. Then we move ahead with the script, and then we, you know, we get writers in, have the script written. And that's the process because you need 3 or 4 drafts to make it interesting. And you keep writing and writing like that. And then, you know, meanwhile, we're looking for locations. What's the best place to shoot? You know, we've shot 3 movies in Belize. So, like, for Poseidon Rex, we thought, oh, let's go back there because we've only used the jungle but not the ocean. And they have beautiful reefs out there, so we can film out there. And there's no, like Los Angeles, if you tried to film in the ocean, you'd have 25 lifeboats out there with environmental protection agencies. And you wouldn't be able to put stuff, you know, we threw life rafts in the water. You couldn't do any of this. So in down in a place like Belize, you can do whatever you want there. So, you know, we went down there and, you know, we could film with all the boats. And then once we had the script, we had the money that from the sales that we had made, and we started shooting. So then, you shoot the movie, and we got the actors from out of L.A., flew them down there. When we do, like, Dragons of Camelot, we get the actors from London and bring them. We shot in Wales. Or, you know, we take actors to Bulgaria or wherever we're going to film, from mostly out of London if it's not in the United States. And then we make the movie, and then, you know, we work on the sales. We deliver to the people who bought it, and we get companies to sell the DVDs, and we collect the money. We get enough of our money back. We go to make the next film. It works something like that.
I like that. That's it in a nutshell, but very interesting to hear the process. Any deviation from that, say, for any of those particular films? I mean, you mentioned the different locations. That's interesting. Any other peculiarities?
Right now, because this is like my own production company, so we can't lose money like a studio. A studio, they making huge films. If they make 6 films, they lose hundreds of millions. They know that one's going to make $300 million. They get their money back. But here, we just, you know, I can't really lose money on a movie. So, you know, I make sure that the companies want the film. So we go around the world. We go, what's really popular? And everyone goes, oh, can you make something about dragons? So enough countries say that, we make a dragon movie. And now, you know, everyone loves Vikings and they love dinosaurs. So everyone said, why don't you put them all in the same movie? Then we'll have double the pleasure, you know. We'll have the Vikings and the dinosaurs in the same movie. So, you know, we're developing this line of movies like that, you know, by you know, not just making something that we want to make, but just something that we know will sell so we can get our money back and make another film. So that's the kind of the way, you know, I've had to operate now because I'm not... You know, the studios aren't calling up and saying, hey, we have our next $30 million film for you. So we have to, you know, use their wits to develop our own movies and projects and stay in business in the film industry and make films this way, which now become a very challenging industry, very challenging, with, you know, a lot of people in it. So you have a lot more competition, so you have to really be that much clever and smarter. When I started making films, the first movie I made, feature film, was 1972, if you can imagine how long ago. And at that year, there were only 200 films made in the United States. 200, that's it. And last year, there were 8,000 films submitted to Sundance alone to get in that festival, 8,000 feature films. So it just to show you, because the competition since I started has increased, you know, so dramatically. There were only 3 film schools when I started in the business, and now they're all over the country. Every city has a film school. There's one in Oklahoma. There's one in Orange County. They're everywhere, right? So, you know, that's a big change, that there's so many more people wanting to be in the film business and work. So, you know, I have the advantage of having so much experience, I can keep going because I know somehow I'm going to get a film made. And, you know, that's I know I'll be able to do it. But, I, you know, so young people starting out, it's somewhat of a struggle, but On the other hand, there's like that's for feature films, but there's a lot of television business. People are going into these webcasts and shorts and all kinds of different vehicles that didn't exist before. Because when I started, remember, there were only three channels on television, 2, 4, and 7. That was it. And
yeah.
Channel 11 ran movies called The Million Dollar Movie.
Right.
But
I'm
now,
from L.A.
You know,
I know.
Yeah. There's 80 channels I saw last night running. 80 or more. What are there, 200 stations now in television? 200 different networks.
You can get hundreds and hundreds. It's just how deep do you want to go, you know, into the genres. We got Time Warner Cable. I don't think we get quite every single one. There's like a premium tier that's just super esoteric that we don't pay for. But, I mean, we have access to, it's hard to figure exactly because a lot of there's several times they repeat, you know, as you go up into the thousands. But I must have 300 or 400 channels available. And so, it is amazing. So you think that number about films, that's staggering. I had no idea there'd been that much of an explosion just in pure volume from 200 slightly over 40 years ago to 8,000 just at Sundance. And I mean, on the one, you know, it parallels so many things that we're talking about, just this time period and the changes in various related industries. And what we're seeing, I mean, the obvious parallel is the internet itself, where you just have an enormous amount of information of every kind and multimedia of every kind, and people are really still trying to figure out how to handle it, you know? How do you deal with it? How do you filter it? How do you edit it? And I think it's very similar situation for film. How do you watch 8,000 films? If you are literally someone who wants to be comprehensive, you know, in 72, you could watch that many movies in a year. I mean, that'd still be a lot, right? But, hey, it's less than one a day. But how do you watch 8,000 movies? I don't think it's possible, is it?
No, it's impossible. That's one of the things that's very hard to break through with content. And, you know, have somebody, some movie people see. There's just so much of it. It's mind-boggling.
So what is your take on it? I mean, what's the good, what's the bad of that those changes, those fundamental changes just in the time of your career? What are the positives? What are the negatives?
Well, the positive is that it's democratized filmmaking to, you know, where anybody can make a film, people making films with a cell phone camera. So information's out there, and, you know, people can take films and make them on any subject. So from a political standpoint, you have, you know, anyone able to make a film. And it's probably a good thing. It opens up all kinds of, you know, media and ideas for people. You know, on the other hand, it's made it much more difficult to make any money on a movie. Just like in the music industry, because
exactly.
There's so much of this content that how do you break through with something? Everything's become niched out where there's so many different types of films and different types of media, and it's not just making one thing. Like when I started out, I made, okay, I'm going to make drive-in movies, and that was a whole industry. There were 5,000 drive-ins. And if you made a movie, you know you were going to be in 3,000 drive-ins, and you make money in your film, you could make another film. Now there's 100 drive-ins in the whole country used for swap meets, right? So, you know, that's
right.
A big shift there. So that's kind of, you know, the positive. The negative is just too many films, too much stuff, and anybody can make a film now. And most of the films, we see lots of them because we're also distributors. And, you know, most people don't know how to make a film, and the films are really bad. And it's really, you know, people have to look at this stuff, and it's just bad. They don't know how to make a film because, you know, but the tools are there, so it's allowed them to do it. So it's like, it becomes like painting where, you know, it's easy to get the materials to paint, but only one person painted sunflowers, right? I mean, there weren't that many great painters considering the number of people who probably could paint over the centuries. So it's like that. There's not that many people that can make a film, but people can do it because the materials are there, because it's easy to get a camera. For $10,000, people are getting their father to give them the money, and they go shoot a movie. But it's not any good. So, you know, you have all that kind of, I guess, is that negative, that there's a lot of bad films floating around? I don't know. You know, but but that's the case. So, you know, that standpoint, it's harder for people who are really good to break through because they're competing with all this clutter and noise of all these kind of films that aren't very good. So, you know, whereas if you could, before, early on, when there were only hundreds of films made, to get the money and make one, it was expensive. So people had to, you know, really come up with something that they knew people were going to want to see. You could make a film. My films in 1970s cost almost the same as today. There's no, it's so much cheaper today. I can make a film almost for the same amount of money.
You're talking about in absolute terms?
Yeah.
I mean, taking inflation
into
account?
In 1973, if you made a movie, maybe it cost you $250,000. But today,
right,
many, many people are making films for $250,000.
Sure. I hear that all the time. Yeah.
Right.
And some of them are relatively...
The $200,000 low-budget film is very common. And that was what it cost to make a film in 1973. So, you know,
that is
that.
Amazing.
So there's all
to
kinds
think about.
Of interesting things happening, you know. And then, but, you know, people do break through, like a film like Beast of the Southern Wild. It's like an amazing movie made for a couple hundred thousand, you know, that wins,
right,
gets nominated for Best Picture against a $100 million film. So there's always.
It
like
is amazing. Quality still somehow, some way, finds a way to bubble up, at least some of the time. Certainly not all the time, you know. I'm sure there's plenty of really good stuff out there that just doesn't find its way. And like you say, it's very similar to music. It's similar. It's analogous to the internet as a whole. It's analogous to TV. I mean, think of all those channels. There's many more opportunities for people and for viewers. You know, whatever you're interested in, man, you can pretty much find a channel for it. And if it's not on cable, you know, then you can find it on the internet. You know, if it hasn't made it to cable, it's on YouTube or the internet. I mean, there's just no topic. But again, the problem is, the issue is, it's exactly what I just heard you say, it's how do we edit these things? You know, how do we cull the ones that are good? How do we move the good stuff up to the top? And of course, to try to answer that question is this entire sub-industry, and it's an element of all industries now, of your social media. What do your friends watch? What do your friends' friends watch or listen to? What do they recommend? So you have all these recommendation type engines of various kinds, you know, technically various kinds. And the point of those is to, in theory, have the good stuff kind of bubble to the top. So since we're mostly talking about where the editing, and I'm not talking about literal editing as in film editing, I'm talking about the people who do the picking and the choosing and the shaping. Do you think it worked better before? Did it work better in the previous era where those gatekeepers, those editors, they were the studio people, they were the people making decisions, or does it work better now where you have a vast volume of every kind at every level of quality and people have to kind of try to sort out the good from the bad themselves? And just as a side note, I'm wondering if that's related, or I guess it probably almost certainly is related, to how important these film festivals have become.
Oh, really? I know. There's like so many everywhere, film festivals. They're every city, everybody has one. You know, they've become really crucial for, you know, these small independent films that we're talking about. And so that's a good thing. I mean, it's got everybody really interested in film. So I think, you know, ultimately I have to say it's a good thing. there's so many people wanting to make films, watch films, be involved in films. So that's all really good.
But it's become, as you said, amateurized, right? So how do we professionalize the amateurization? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
How do we find the good stuff when there's so much stuff and everyone can do it?
I think the people who make a living at it become professionals, and the people who can't make a living at it because their films don't have any audience or can't make any profit back, they end up going out of the business, and that's pretty much always been the case. So, you know, if you can make a living at it and pay your bills and make it a full-time job, then you're probably a professional. Then you are a professional at that level, I would say. So those people will continue to work and make films. And, you know, the ones that are just making things that nobody's interested in, nobody wants to see, they're going to go away, you know.
Back to your career. What's your favorite movie that you made?
Well, I would say, you know, the most exciting one. I mean, people love Commando. I was just in Austin, Texas, doing a Q&A. It was sold out with 400 people. I mean, still drawing that crowd. And, you know, people coming dressed up in the costumes of the characters in the film. So, you know, that was exciting. But Class of 1984 is my favorite movie of, you know, because I wrote it, I produced it, I directed it. It had a very controversial political theme to it. So that film, I think, is near perfection. It's become such a cult classic. So I really appreciate that. That's been very exciting. And, you know, of course, Commando, I watched it again last week. Everyone loves that film. And, you know, there again, it's kind of a perfect film, but there's no CGI. It's done it's fun because it's all happening right there on the screen, so there's nothing to take away from it with all of this extra action and CGI of just spinning cars everywhere and all that. It's actually, you know, a very soulful movie because you have a character you like and you're following him.
Right, right. Well, I'm sure it is very gratifying that such a personal movie as 1984 is, you know, has achieved the status that it has. When I was just reading up on you and kind of just, you know, checking around, reading bios in various places and career overviews, and every single one of them kind of centered on that one, saying that, yeah, that one had something more that reached a different level than the others. How often do you write? How often are you a screenwriter? Or have you been?
Well, no, mostly I hire writers to do, you know, various pictures. So I don't do too much writing myself. I come up with the idea, the story idea, and then I have writers write them.
How do you hand that off? How does that handoff process work? How deep into the story do you have to go when you write it? Or how much detail do you have to go into?
Oh, quite a bit. You know, I'll write a whole treatment out of what the story's going to be, and then I'll have a writer flesh the scripts out because I don't have the patience anymore because I'm also working on raising money or finishing the last film or distributing films. So, you know, the writers have to sit there day after day just writing to be any good. So, you know, I give that process over to writers to write. And then, you know, it's writing is rewriting, so we get back many, many versions of the script before we center on it and say this is good enough to shoot.
Right. I'm picturing you all these arms moving. You are multitasking at all times. How do you have the energy?
Oh, man, I just keep going. I don't know. It's I have the same energy as when I started, because if you love what you're doing, that's what I tell people. You know, if you love what you're doing, I don't have any hobbies because this is my hobby, making films. So I love doing it. I'm not on a golf course, so I can't retire. I just like making films. So I'll always be a filmmaker. And it's funny, I was at the Cannes Film Festival last year, and a director came with his movie. This is my last movie. Alan Renan, he died shortly thereafter, a couple weeks ago, actually. And he was 91 years old. He was still shooting movies. So I thought, yeah, that's pretty cool. I'll just keep going like that.
Well, Clint Eastwood isn't getting any younger.
No, he's older than me, a lot older.
There's a lot, you know, they keep going. I mean, because you're an artist, you know, and unlike many professions, you know, in sports, sadly, I mean, you're it is a rare sport where you can function at the very highest level, you know, at the world-class level, certainly much past 30 and really rare past 40. But in the arts, and I think writing and probably directing too, filmmaking, I suppose, there doesn't seem to be that upper limit. And even music too, popular music, when you look at it, people may get better. They get better with age in terms of they are objectively better at what they do. They're better at their instrument. Maybe their voice gets better. They become a technically better songwriter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever the case may be. But it seems to be there's some spark, at least in popular music, you know, that just seems to be really special and seems to be most prominent. And there's exceptions, of course, but seems to come out best when people are, you know, quite young. I mean, 20s, 30s, even younger. But in film and where I am now, I guess, being an author, I do lots of different things too and like to be multimedia. And we certainly hope to eventually have a TV show, America's Most Haunted TV show, and I certainly would love to be involved with that. But, I mean, I write more than I do anything else. And that seems to be an area where you can just keep going. And the things that you – the wisdom – and the experience that comes with age, it seems that you can express that more easily in some of the arts, in writing and filmmaking, than in, you know, most other ways. Most fields you have to retire. Still, you know, there's still, it's changing a little, but there's still mandatory retirement in many fields. So I would think that that's a great, if you're someone who is youthful and energetic and loves what they do and wants to keep going, in life and not just kind of retire. And I mean, I've never thought about retirement. I just can't even, I don't even exactly know what it means, really, you know. And it sounds like you're absolutely the same way.
No, and movie makers, you know, they go, John Huston was directing in his 80s, and, you know, so many directors, they'll keep going and going. Of course, it's a young town, a young business, so, you know, people always want the newest thing, you know, and the newest person, the youngest person, but there's, you know, in Europe, it's not quite that way. There, they respect the, you know, people with experience, and especially in places like Japan, you know, directors there, they go forever, you know, they keep shooting and shooting, and same in France. I mean, as directors are well into their 80s, they keep working, so there's no limit to the arts in that sense. Yeah, it's not like sports where you're, by 40 years old, you're done completely.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. You know, sure. I think in particular the baby boom generation refusing to give up, refusing to get old. You know, you've developed a lot of these older, you know, if not leagues, just various competitions or whatnot. You're allowed to continue to be an athlete as long as you can at this point, and there's always some competition you can take part in. But, you know, as far as participating at that highest level, at the world-class level, no, it's not going to happen. The body just doesn't have – you lose too much. And, of course, that could be changing too with some of these amazing changes. I mean, we're getting to the point now in the very, very near future where we're going to have to really take into account artificial, not just limbs, but organs, and, you know, artificial elements to the body. We've already had an Olympian with two artificial limbs. Turned out he's a murderer too, but, you know, I mean, think about how amazing that was. You know, he wasn't just in the Special Olympics. He was in the real Olympics. He was on.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. Yes.
He was on the South African relay. I don't know if it was 4x100 or 4x200, but he was literally one of the four on the South African sprint team, relay team. And he didn't do all that well, actually, compared to what they anticipated. But still, think about it. You know, the implications are, okay, well, he'd have done better if his, you know, if the artificial limbs had been better. I don't know if it was that or just, you know, what he was able to do with them. But the fact that that barrier has been broken is kind of amazing to think about. And I think we're just going to see it. And it's the near future we're talking about. Life is going to be prolonged. People are going to be sort of – I'm not concerned. The things that make the most sense to me, I'm not concerned about the machines taking over, because I think what's going to happen is we're just going to keep incorporating the best that the machines have to offer into ourselves and making ourselves hybrid. And as long as we stay in charge of ourselves, then I think that's probably okay. But I'm not sure. There may be a point where you no longer know if you're really, really in charge. Sounds like there's a movie there that someone like Mark Lester should make.
Yeah, I think, is there one coming out called Transference or something about the computer?
Oh, yeah, with Johnny Depp. That's very – but that's completely uploading – the entire personality. That's uploading a human being, their mind, their personality, their soul in theory, up into a computer. And that's kind of a different thing. That's what's that, Transference, I think? Is the
yes,
name
I think
it?
That's what it's called, yes.
That's a different thing. That's, I'm less concerned about that because I just don't think that's, I think that's farther off than some of the futurists are saying. You know, this Kurzweil guy, he's been saying, you know, we're going to get to the point where we're computer power, that we have enough access to computer power, and it's fast enough and cheap enough that we will literally be able to do with this, what that movie's about, and it's upload our entire self, our life, all of our experiences, everything that makes us us, up into a computer. I'm not convinced that that's realistic anytime very soon at all. It may be realistic down the line, hundreds of years or thousands of years, probably is. But I'm still not sure if that would be you, though, that uploaded entity. But what is realistic, and like I say, I mean, it's already happening. I mean, it's already going on, is as we sort of incorporate the best that machines and the micro machines, the nanotechnology, into ourselves to just supplement ourselves and to make us stronger and healthier and to repair ourselves from within. That's happening now. So, I mean, 100 years from now, I think people – a lot of people alive now, I think the potential is there for people to be utterly shocked by what we become in the very near future. And I see, as a result of that, extended lifespans, much healthier lives, you know, able to mitigate a lot of the things that wear us down, that come into play as we age. You know, a lot of people thinking about this, I mean, who wants to live to 200 years old if you're old and decrepit for 120 of those years? I mean, I don't, you know, but if you can be youthful and vigorous and do all the things that you love to do and experience the things that you care about and function at a high level for those 200 years, then hell yeah, man, I'd love to do that.
We'll have to become vampires. That's what we should do, you know.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. that's a whole other world, boy. The more vampire, you know, mythologies that I observe, either film, TV, books, on and on, on and on, the less I want to be a vampire, because that's a tough life, morally, and even seems like, you know, spiritually, and I don't know. That kind of living forever, that's tough. Wow. Well, this hour has gone very, very quickly. What a pleasure to talk to you. I mean,
yeah,
you really
happy
are.
To be
you're
on.
A
That's
Hollywood
great.
Legend.
Great show, and any time I'd be happy to be on.
Well, we need to find out about what's going on with the with the Vikings and the freaking dinosaurs. I want to know all about that one when that comes together. And it just sounds like you're really having fun and doing what you love doing and having success doing it, man. I applaud you absolutely. You are living the life, you know, and you're in that range where you're able to do that. You know, you're able to function. You don't have vast amount of spotlight on you. You're out there doing your own thing, and that is a tremendous thing. That is worthy of respect, and you have mine.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Very inspiring to hear that, so I appreciate it. And I'll keep
Absolutely.
Going. I'll keep making more films. Hopefully people like them, and I'll keep making them. It'll be a lot of fun.
I'm really interested to see. So did you say that this third 1984 film, is it a trilogy? I mean, is this a continuation?
No, this is a remake, actually, of the original. So I have the remake rights, and I realized that my other films were all being remade, Commando, Firestarter. So I thought, what do I still own? What do I own myself that the studios don't own that was a hit that I could remake? And I said, well, I could remake that, and boy, how contemporary now with all high school shootings and so forth.
Sure.
So I had to find kind of a new take on it because it's a very disturbing subject now. So, you know, we have one, and it's going to be really great. It's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be like a Clockwork Orange type movie set in the near future where rich people's kids are in high school and are in private school to protect themselves, and it doesn't help them in this movie that we're going to make.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, that will be exciting, and I will look forward to that, and I'd certainly love to talk to you about that when it comes along. All
right,
Mark. Well,
okay, thank you so much.
Congrats on Poseidon
okay.
Rex. Hope it does super well. I think it's really well done and fun, and I think people, you know, the people I've talked to about it said, yeah, man, that's the kind of creature feature we love. You know, it's well done, it's professional, but it's also fun and doesn't take itself too seriously.
Well, thank you so much. Okay, so we'll talk soon. Thank you.
All right, great. Have a good evening.
Okay, thank you. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, my friends. Well, that was fascinating. Really, really interesting. Love talking with Mark Lester. I've been hearing that name for 40 years as I was reading through the roster of films that he's either directed or produced or written or some combination of all of the above. I mean, there are dozens of them, and I've seen many, 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 many of them. Really interesting, and it's interesting to hear his take on what has changed over the 40-year period in terms of filmmaking. And as we were saying, there's a lot of parallels kind of across the board in media where you've had the switchover from analog to digital. That's one of the issues. And you've had the switchover from really narrow gatekeeping in terms of who's allowed to make albums or make movies or make TV shows to an amazing democratization. And now you have this enormous volume. I did not realize 8,000 films were submitted simply to Sundance. And of course, that's not even all the movies or even close to all the movies being made. So with those dramatic changes, of course, come good and bad things, and that's just part of the world we live in. All right, well, thanks for listening to America's Most Haunted. I'm Eric Olson. We will, of course, be back next week. And what are we doing? Let me take a quick look. I know it is something good. We're still booked up about 3 or 4 weeks into the future, which is always good. It means there's lots of interest. Next week, we will be talking about the Afterlife Conference with the director, Terry Daniel. And that's a really high-end conference. That is looking not so much at the paranormal, although aspects of the paranormal, but really taking seriously some of the latest discoveries about that border, that thin, ever-thinning border between life and the afterlife, and what that means and what we can do to prepare. So there's lifestyle elements to it and whatnot. That's the Afterlife Conference. We'll be talking about that next week, as always, at 10 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday night on America's Most Haunted Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week.